This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Over 6,000 Haitians are in American custody, waiting to find out whether they will be sent back to their country or given asylum in the U.S. Haitians have been fleeing to South Florida ever since the September coup that overthrew Reverend Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president. The Bush administration had been forcibly deporting the Haitians, saying they fled for economic reasons and do not qualify for political asylum. But on November 19th, a federal judge in Miami issued a temporary order stopping the forced repatriation. Last night, the ban was extended in response to a lawsuit that challenged the screening procedures used by the Immigration and Naturalization Service to determine whether Haitian boat people are legitimate political refugees. Anyone claiming to be a political refugee is entitled to a fair hearing. It is U.S. policy not to return political refugees whose life or freedom would be threatened upon their return. The story of the Haitian immigrants is provoking Americans to examine their attitudes toward accepting refugees in these difficult economic times. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Frank Sherry, who has worked with Vietnamese boat people, Marielistas, Salvadorans, and other refugees. He opposes the forced repatriation of the Haitian boat people. First, we'll hear from Congressman Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas who sits on the House Subcommittee on Immigration. Smith supports the Bush administration policy.
What the United States is doing, and which I think has to be the basis of any immigration and refugee policy, is to treat everyone in a very consistent and even-handed manner. And what the United States is doing is enforcing the definition of refugee as being an individual who has a well-founded fear of persecution because of their race or because of their religion or political beliefs, for example. And all United Nations countries follow this particular definition. So it's not that the United States is doing anything any differently than any other country.
Now, critics of the Bush administration's policy on refugees say that our administration has been applying the definition of political versus economic refugee with a racist or ideological slant, yeah. And that we've been more generous in allowing in refugees who are coming from communist countries because we've opposed communism, that right. We are, and that we're going to be less generous to people who are poor and black who are trying to come
right.
in.
First of all, as far as racism goes, I need to mention here that, of course, individuals coming from Haiti are black, and the fact that we've sent back 500 sometimes overshadows the fact that, for instance, in 1990, we admitted 20,000 legally from Haiti. In 1988, we admitted 35,000 legally from Haiti. So clearly it's not a racist effort to try to repatriate some Haitians who are trying to come in illegally. And the other thing is, don't forget that most of the, for instance, 10 million immigrants that we are admitting to the United States in this decade are individuals of color. So there's clearly no racism involved here. As far as political goes, there are instances of countries, for instance, where there has been a communist government where we do feel that individuals have a well-founded fear of persecution because of their political views. In Haiti, that doesn't seem to be the case, simply because individuals have been trying to get to the United States from Haiti both before the coup in last September and since the coup.
What makes you so confident that the Haitians are economic and not political refugees?
Well, first of all, we monitor the situation in Haiti pretty closely. We've got the media over there. We've got all these humanitarian organizations that are monitoring the scene. And there was some very initial violence immediately after the coup, which has now subsided. It was just a day or two in duration. And now there doesn't seem to be any political vengeance that's being wreaked on opponents of the administration, for example. And the individuals themselves, I guess, are the best witness to that. When they are being interviewed at Guantanamo Base, they're not saying we're here because of political views that we held and we're afraid for our lives or we're afraid for our families. They're coming here and they freely admit it, and it's a credit to their honesty, simply because Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
You're concerned not only about opening our doors to the Haitians who are trying to come to the United States. You're concerned in general that America not open its doors too wide to refugees. What are your concerns about the impact that opening our doors too wide to refugees would have?
Well, you eventually get to the point where there's an economic adverse impact. And by that I mean it seems that most refugees are going to, when they come to the United States, are going to compete directly with the same type of individual who's already here. And those are individuals in the lower socioeconomic class. In the case of the refugees, most of them don't speak English, for example. Most of them don't have a high level of education. And they're going to be competing for jobs with the same types of individuals, as I say, the lower sort of lower socioeconomic individuals here in the United States. And there's only, it seems like, so many jobs for those individuals. And if you talk to, for instance, the public officials and the taxpayers that live in countries that seem to have a large number of refugees, for instance, Florida or California, they will say, look, you know, it's driving up the unemployment rate. Our government services are being stretched to the breaking point because we do need to provide educational services and health services and other social services to these individuals. So there is a limit, and the question is, what is that limit?
What about the argument that so many refugees who come to the United States are determined and hardworking, and they want to succeed, and they work very hard at it? Many of them start new businesses. Many of them really add to the economy rather than take away from it.
That's certainly true, and my heart goes out to individuals and like those that whom you've just described. But at the same time, there are other individuals who don't contribute in the same way as the hardworking individuals that you've just described. And unfortunately, a study has recently been conducted of changes in the type of individuals who are coming to this country. And it seems that they are less well-educated, they are less inclined to work hard and get a job, and much more likely to, for instance, to be on the welfare rolls than immigrants and refugees from previous decades. And that is not a reason to exclude people. And I ought to say here also that of those 10 million people that the United States is going to admit in this decade, roughly 85% are going to be admitted without regard to their education or without regard to their skills. Only 15% fall into the sort of the skilled immigrant category. So the United States is very, very generous, I think, in its policy, and the individuals who are willing to work hard and contribute to the economy should be encouraged to do so. And I think that most of those 10 million will be in that category. But at some point, there just does, unfortunately, in this era of budget constraints and this era of limited job opportunities, seem to be a limit on the number of individuals that can be admitted to the United States without adversely impacting our own American citizens.
Well, Congressman, thank you very much for your time.
Enjoy being with you. Thank you.
Lamar Smith is a Republican congressman from Texas. He sits on the House Subcommittee on Immigration. Coming up, we'll hear from a refugee rights advocate who opposes the Bush administration's repatriation of the Haitians. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank Sherry, who opposes the forced repatriation of the Haitian boat people. He's the executive director of the National Immigration, Refugee, and Citizenship Forum in Washington, D.C. Over the past 12 years, he's worked with Vietnamese boat people, Marialistas, Central Americans, and Mexicans. The Bush administration is arguing that the Haitians are economic refugees and are therefore not entitled to political asylum. I asked Sherry to explain the distinction.
What they're basically trying to argue is that the primary motivation for Haitians leaving Haiti is the economic devastation in the on the island, and not political persecution. The reason that they're making this argument is that U.S. law allows for the protection of those fleeing persecution or generalized terror, but it does not allow for the protection or admission of those fleeing economic problems. So what they're trying to do is to cast the Haitian boat people in terms of trying to categorize them, if you will, as illegal aliens rather than as political refugees. And in doing so, justifying their attempts to repatriate them. Of course, all reports from Haiti indicate that the illegal regime that has overthrown the democratically elected government of Aristide is wreaking tremendous terror on the general population, going through neighborhoods and areas, particularly those which are supportive of the ousted president, shooting people randomly, terrorizing people, arresting people, torturing people. The notion that people are fleeing economic misery at this point really flies in the face of every report coming out of Haiti, as well as the interviews done with Haitians that have left.
To qualify as a political refugee, do you have to prove that your name is on a hit list? Do you have to prove that you, in particular, are being targeted by the government?
In some cases, unfortunately, that's the way it's practiced. In law, basically what you have to prove is that you have a well-founded fear of persecution. So even if it's a subjective fear, if you think that people in my situation are getting offed and I don't want to go back, and you can make that argument convincingly, even if you can't produce documentation, at least in theory, you should qualify as a refugee. But there's two. There's a situation that in law that that has developed recently, which is quite interesting, because in the case of Haitians, we don't argue that every Haitian leaving Haiti right now can prove a fear of individualized persecution. But what virtually all can show is that they're fleeing a situation of generalized terror, of a breakdown in law and order, of random violence that puts, in fact, the entire population in some jeopardy. As a result of these kinds of situations, which weren't contemplated by refugee law, last year Congress passed a new provision, something called temporary protected status, which is exactly for people who are fleeing generalized violence, political violence, but can't prove individualized persecution. This is called temporary protected status. It's been invoked for a number of other nationalities, and it's something that we believe would be a very reasonable approach to the situation with Haitians. Give them temporary safe haven until the democratically elected government is restored.
What would it take to do that?
Well, the way the law is written, it's the Attorney General has the authority to designate Haiti for temporary protected status. And there have been a number of appeals from congressional leaders, religious leaders, African-American leaders, Haitian leaders, etc., to ask the Attorney General and the administration to simply invoke the law, which is really relates directly to this situation. Unfortunately, the Bush administration has refused to do so.
Some critics of the Bush administration have said that it's really racism or ideology that's behind some of the immigration policies that we have. Do you think that that would be applicable, in your opinion, to the Bush administration's stand on the Haitians?
Well, I'm afraid so. This grows out of a long, long debate and controversy surrounding Haitian refugees. In fact, the U.S. has, unfortunately, in the last 10 years, discriminated against refugees primarily on ideological grounds. For example, refugees from Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, or communist-dominated countries have always received favorable treatment in U.S. refugee policy, while Haitians, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and others who flee governments that have been friendly with the Reagan and Bush administrations have received really quite harsh and discriminatory treatment. You know, for example, in 1986, you know, Libyans and people from the Soviet Union were approved for refugee status at a rate of 80-90%, while Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Haitians were approved for asylum at a rate of less than 2%. And there's no denying that they've discriminated on that basis. The question of race and racism is a bit more highly charged. Congressman Rangel of Harlem, though, has posed the question to officials that I think is a good one. He said, if there was a situation in Ireland where a thug army took over the government and there were boatloads of Irish who were who have fled and were in boats, rickety boats, off of the island of Ireland, would the U.S. government pick those people up and argue that it was safe to repatriate them? And I think everyone knows the answer to that. And the notion that the U.S. treatment of Haitians has always been harsher than for others. The U.S. has an interdiction agreement, for example, with the government of Haiti, that it started with Baby Doc Duvalier, which gave them license to intercept Haitian boats and give them a cursory screening to see if they're, quote, political refugees. And for the most part, it was a policy designed to just deport en masse Haitians who were trying to get to the U.S. who were fleeing a dictatorship. And it's always been a controversial policy. And the fact remains is that such an interdiction agreement exists with no other government in the world.
My guest is Frank Sherry. He's the executive director of the National Immigration, Refugee, and Citizenship Forum based in Washington, D.C. Now, in your work, you are really trying to open America's doors to more immigrants and to give Salvadorans and Haitians temporary protected status. A lot of people are concerned that we're keeping our doors open a little too wide and that Americans are out of work now and Americans are having a hard time providing for themselves, and that by opening our doors to more refugees, there's not only going to be more competition for jobs, but also city and state governments are having such a difficult time providing for the people who live there already. How are they going to deal with more people coming in areas like Florida, for instance? What would you say to that? How do you balance those concerns with your concerns for protecting refugees?
There's a lot of common sense notions about refugees and immigrants and their impact. And in fact, they really need to be questioned, and in many cases, these myths about the negative impact of immigrants need to be debunked. If I could just give you a couple of examples.
I mean, yeah, please.
I talk to people all the time about this, and most people, even sort of liberally inclined people, say, well, wait a minute, you know, refugees and immigrants, great, but they take jobs, they reduce wages, they don't learn English fast enough, they cost government a lot, they use a lot of social services, you know, particularly in a time of recession, shouldn't we just kind of close the door? Now, if you buy the basic arguments, well, of course, closing the door sounds like a reasonable conclusion. The fact is that research from across the political spectrum shows that just the opposite in terms of the impact of refugees and immigrants is true. And if you think about it, it's kind of obvious. In fact, refugees and immigrants come to the United States, they don't only take jobs, they make jobs. They work hard, they open businesses, they're generally young, and as a result, they create economic growth. And this is something that is often overlooked. If you think of communities in Washington, D.C., or Miami, or Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, Boston, New York, areas which really receive a higher number in Miami, a higher number of immigrants than others, there's whole areas and neighborhoods that have been revitalized by newcomers. And in fact, many economists argue that immigrants are so beneficial to the economy that we should expand the number of immigrants so that there's more economic growth. Now, I know that this flies in the face of these so-called common sense notions, but if you take a very objective view at the real impact of immigrants and refugees, by and large and overall, it's overwhelmingly positive in terms of the self-interest of the United States.
The impact that you're looking at is more of a long-term impact. In the short term, there's a lot of chaos and people without homes. Who do you think should share in that responsibility of finding homes and work and housing for people who've just arrived?
Well, the fact is that most refugees and immigrants come to the United States and receive very little government assistance. The one exception would be refugees who are legally resettled. They have sponsors. There's special English classes and so forth set up for them. But for the most part, legal immigrants, which is the majority of people who come in, or people who come in seeking refugee status as asylum applicants, by and large get very little. And they're helped by family members, or if they're sponsored by an employer, helped by their employers. So there's chaos and there's difficulty, but it's quite frankly suffered much more by the immigrants themselves than by the communities.
In your many years of working with refugees, one of the things that you did was work with a resettlement program trying to settle hard-to-place refugees from the Mariel boat lift. What were some of the things you were up against in trying to settle people who were hard-to-place? Well, what exactly does that mean?
Well, if you remember in 1980, when the Mariel boat lift occurred, about an untold number, maybe 15, 20,000 of the Cubans that came over in the Mariel boat lift, and of 125,000, most were, again, sort of lived out have been living out that American dream of working hard and making it. But there were a number of people who were released directly from prison, and even some reportedly from mental institutions. believe me, it was no easy trick, and it was not an easy go, and the tremendous resistance in the communities we worked in. By and large, people did work out okay, but we certainly did have people who we helped resettle who didn't make it and ended up back in jail. And it's a real sort of black chapter in U.S. immigration history on all sides, from the Castro government sending people from prisons in a cynical move, to the administration not knowing what to do about it and jailing them indefinitely for a long time, to communities really throwing up their hands and saying, we don't want these people. And unfortunately, it was a tough chapter. And but we did our best, and we're trying to help folks make it. And in fact, 8 out of 10 did, but the two that didn't, really caused a great deal of concern and fear in a lot of communities. And unfortunately, we're still living with that legacy today.
What were some of the difficult decisions you had to make? Because you knew that some of the people you were dealing with would be among those two people who would turn to crime again.
Well, in fact, we were social service operators, but in fact, we were regularly involved in, we had sort of extraordinary powers to revoke someone's parole. So when we saw someone becoming a danger, and this will make the civil libertarian shudder, we had the authority to literally call up the immigration service and have someone picked up and sent back to jail. And we were regularly faced with those kinds of decisions, and we made them simply because we were trying to balance the chances of some sort of integration into the community with the needs of the community to be protected. So those were the toughest decisions, was to pick up a phone and have someone sent to jail indefinitely.
What are the priorities on your agenda now?
I think the most pressing concerns these days are this much more difficult area of people who are fleeing political violence and persecution. The Haitian situation is our top priority right now. We're also working quite a bit with Salvadoran refugees who, again, have been treated very roughly by the Reagan and Bush administration throughout the 1980s, a group of people fleeing a country where 70,000 civilians have been killed in a bloody civil war. And unfortunately, for most of the decade, the administration said that they're not refugees, they're economic migrants, and they did everything they could to arrest and deport them. Thankfully, last year, as part of this immigration bill, we were able to win legislation which gave them temporary protected status or temporary safe haven. And we've been working very hard on that, and we're very concerned that Salvadorans be able to stay in the U.S. until the conditions exist in El Salvador for their safe return.
Well, Frank Sherry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Frank Sherry is the executive director of the National Immigration, Refugee, and Citizenship Forum. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.